Audio version of Michael Leitman's blog. June 22, 2020. My article in Newsmax, Masks and Freedom. America, like the rest of the world, faces an ongoing war against an invisible enemy, COVID-19. Prevention of its spread, though, is highly visible in the use of face masks. This prophylactic measure has split the public between those who refuse to wear masks based on their right of free choice, and those who regard face covering as an act of solidarity with others to limit the pandemic's transmission. Thus, the virus has provided us with an exemplary exercise in mutual responsibility, since we will all need to realize that, because we are in the same boat, consideration of collective wellness must supersede individual calculations. Some feel face coverings infringe on their freedom of choice, but if more wear them, we'll have more freedom to go out, said U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams. Studies show that face coverings are critical to helping limit the spread of the coronavirus, and yet, many people still defy requirements to wear masks in public settings. Others follow the advice of medical doctors to the letter, while most are found somewhere in between. Because COVID-19 is a new and previously unstudied disease, it has evoked in us fear of the unknown. It is not clear what would happen if, God forbid, we were infected. Therefore, uncertainty is causing a general feeling of hysteria. The coronavirus disease is discussed on the media from morning to night, and every political and professional personality tries to take advantage of the situation to demonstrate how clever or important they are and that they know the best way for the country to go forward. If they happen to be correct, it is to their credit, but if not, it is somebody else's fault. As always, success has many parents and failure is an orphan. If there had been separate locations for the cautious and the careless, things might have worked out. However, we are inseparably interconnected in this situation, so what do we do? The solution lies in the way we calculate the risks. Whether I am extremely worried about the disease, unconcerned, or somewhere in the middle, perhaps there is a need to change the focus of my attention. In other words, instead of measuring what I feel and think about the risk of contracting the virus, I should measure how my behavior might impact others. That is, I have to tell myself that I may be a carrier, and whether or not others are infected depends on me. Consequently, I should consider my behavior every moment and in every place to ensure that I do not transmit the virus to others, and thus I guard their health. Unfortunately, the public is not yet very mindful of personal responsibility because, day in and day out, we are bombarded with conflicting opinions of doctors and others. This leaves us confused. While consideration of a variety of opinions is a positive thing, the public needs a clear and informed direction in the end. If we continue down the road we are traveling now, we will come to a situation where each person follows his own advice and no precautions for the general welfare are possible. This would drive people even further away from the security of living in an orderly society. The circumstance in which each follows his or her natural tendency to consider only themselves to be the world authority will only create mayhem and drive us to anarchy. A public agreement to wear face masks for the sake of others can help prevent such a slide toward social disorder. Wherever there is a dispute between the collective and the individual, we are obliged to rule according to the will of the collective. Why? Because by doing so, we align with the general connecting force of nature that is able to positively permeate society, as opposed to the negative egoistic force of the individual that disintegrates order. As it is written, in the multitude of people is the king's honor. Proverbs 14:28. And this is also the bottom line. Though some of us are wary and some are careless according to our innate characteristics, a healthy society must be linked to a new consideration, the benefit of others. If every person tries to always act in favor of others, there will be no need for either excessive fear or disregard. We would all be in tune with the integral system of nature where balance prevails, And we will discover that ultimate freedom is found when one upholds the interest of the collective, which is, after all, the sum of every single one of us. Experiment, 5 days in complete isolation. Comment, we know that people are immersed in the internet now, they don't seem to need anyone, just a gadget and internet access. Recently, an experiment was conducted, 5 days in a single, cozy cell without the internet. My response, that is a death-like experience. Question, this was in the UK, where TV Channel 5 launched the show called In Solitary, the anti-social experiment. Each person had a single, comfortable cell with a soft bed, sanitary conditions, and wholesome food for 5 days. But the main condition was complete solitude. People could only draw, read, and talk to themselves. And within a few hours, they began to panic. Everyone coped with this panic in different ways. One pressed the rescue button, one started talking to the surveillance cameras, and another had an upset stomach. Only one person, a female blogger, who had set herself the goal of getting rid of her habit in this way, had brought pencils, markers, and a lot of paper, and she drew some meaningless pictures. What was the conclusion of the experiment? Researchers write that a social being, a human, suffers from loneliness, but a citizen of the modern world with constant internet access does not fully realize this until he is completely isolated. Mankind and loneliness, are these categories compatible? Answer, a person, who had always been closed in the world and now finds himself torn away from it, feels a huge vacuum. He worked at the base of this world, day, night, news, and so on, all of these programs and calls, and suddenly he no longer has access to any of it. Of course, this is a huge void for him. People used to live in such emptiness. I remember my childhood and youth until the 90s. In 1995, I created my first website, Kabbalah.info. Before that, how did we live? We had newspapers and television. Before television, which came to me in 1955, we had newspapers and books. Question, what has changed in a person in just 50 years that he suddenly cannot be alone? Answer, a person has a connection with the world and he cannot live without this connection. It is not the electronic web, it is the web of connections between us that has opened up. We can no longer exist without feeling each other. But, we fill this feeling with completely different thoughts, news, and with other unnecessary things. But, in general, we have discovered a web of connections between us. I feel like I am connected to it and I cannot do without it. It is like air to me. I am connected and I feed from it, I get this information feed and it keeps me going. Without it, I do not feel like I am alive. Question, if you take out the layers of information that a person receives, what is still important to him in this web of communication? Answer, look at what is going on in the evening on TV news and sports programs. Here, they dance, they shout at each other, and argue. All of this is now called the world or our world. If it were all turned off, do you understand what would happen to the world? The world would plunge into the Middle Ages. The Middle Ages. People will have such a lack of information. They don't need it and they can, in principle, survive without it, but they won't be able to. They are already different. You can view the news as it is presented and you will see that out of every 100 news items, maybe one or two will interest you enough to open them, and all the rest, you don't need. But you cannot do without them. Comment, researchers write that all of this information showered on a person causes stress because it is so superfluous to him. My response, but he cannot be without stress. Question, how would you fill the content of these programs? Answer, I can choose the content, but it would require completely different people. We need to educate people. It is necessary for us to educate people regarding how to discover the source of life and the source of the world and how, not to be lost in these streams of news that are composed for them. A person is in need of good connection. In need of good communication. And the web doesn't make any connections. It's just like a spider's web. Question: what is a web of good communication? Answer: this is when each person thinks about how to do good to others. Comment: and then, if he is isolated. My response: this web will still act on him because others will think about him. Question: and you don't need any gadgets for that? Answer: nothing is needed. Only good intentions that will connect people with each other. People will be connected in such a way that everyone will feel one another's good intentions and nothing else is needed. And, from this, everyone will be delighted and feel a sense of meaning of existence and in their capacity to rise above their I and so on. This is necessary. I have no doubt that we will succeed. From CabTV's News with Dr. Michael Leitman, March 3, 2020. What does that virus point to? Question: if all unnecessary jobs disappear, 90% of the population will remain unemployed. What will these people do and how will the economy support itself without these jobs? Answer: but the people who occupied these places did nothing useful. What did they work for? To throw money around? What are we afraid of giving up? Doing useless work, taking from one place so another can pull it out and throw it to another place? So some people can dig a hole and others fill it up? Question: Balha Sulam wrote in the newspaper The Nation, clearly, the measure of egoism inherent in every creature is a necessary condition in the actual existence of the creature. Without it, it would not be a separate and distinct being in itself. Yet, this should not at all deny the measure of altruism in a person. The only thing required is to set distinct boundaries between them. The law of egoism must be kept in all its might, to the extent that it concerns the minimum existence. And with any surplus of that measure, permission is granted to waive it for the well-being of one's fellow person. We only need to find out what the benefit of others is. This is not just to redistribute production toward minimal necessities, but to determine what benefits will flow from this to others. How will we experience this, and what is this trend? Answer: I think we need to create a new group of states that can really solve this. But there must be leaders who understand the integrality of the world and the need of the moment to bring it to an integral form. Question: where can we find such leaders and politicians? Look what is happening. Trump is now blaming China. China is responding in the same way. Conflicts arise. The same trends as before. The world has not changed. Answer: we, the Kabbalists, need to move in the direction of our vision. We must explain, in every possible way, advertise and disseminate our knowledge, which is consistent with the laws of nature. Nature will not allow us to do anything else. As soon as everyone starts going back to the old ways, the mutated virus will hit even harder. Now its consequences are harmless. According to statistics, during the worldwide reign of the virus, far fewer people have died than if it had not existed. But the virus works for the whole system of humankind, and if we do not do what it is pointing us to, that is, if we do not become integrally interconnected, then nothing good will come out of it. Wait and see. We are still on the way toward it. I see that, unfortunately, all countries want to return to the way things were in the past. From CabTV's Fundamentals of Kabbalah, March 5, 2020. Crises are a consequence of imbalance in nature. Question: now in many countries people are starting to slowly take to the streets, fill up coffee houses, and go shopping. Can this going out of the house be called going out of the crisis? Answer: no. Going out of the crisis means that we really understand what it means to be in the crisis, to get out of it, and to already have exited it. Until how we have not even delved into what happened to us. We do not know the nature of this virus, how to completely get rid of it, whether it has other forms, whether they are recurring, etc. Therefore, we cannot confidently claim that we know where we are. Everything is as usual. A person wants to live as conveniently, comfortably, and simply as possible. We can no longer afford to stay at home and therefore, they say we are exiting the crisis, running away from where we stayed closed in for a while. But I would not say that by this we are really getting rid of the crisis. The fact is that the crisis is a consequence of the pressure of nature on us, which wants to see us integrally connected with all its parts. Its inanimate, vegetative, and animate levels work together in unison. And due to the fault of human egoism, nature throws us out of its framework, puts us outside of itself. By its crises and cataclysms, tsunamis, volcanoes, hurricanes, and earthquakes, nature indicates that we arouse very bad, unbalanced forces in it and do not want to be its integral part. In order to do this, we need to become interdependent, interconnected between us. But we do not want that and cannot do it, therefore, humanity has problems. Now we have reached the point where nature begins to push us to happiness with a stick. So all kinds of viruses are activated, which will inevitably push us toward connection, toward a more correct attitude toward ourselves and nature. In the near future, this will become clearer, until we understand how to behave. Question: the feeling of the crisis is a feeling that evil rules the world? Answer: the feeling of the crisis is those compulsive forces of nature that manifest themselves in order to balance the egoistic disturbances that we cause in nature. From Cab TV's Fundamentals of Kabbalah, May 10, 2020. Equivalence of the Integral System. Question: we do not understand the relationship between man and nature, let alone the relationship between people. They are totally hidden. For example, the destruction of sparrows in China in the 60s led to famine in a country of tens of millions of people. The extermination of cats in North Korea caused the emergence of a huge number of rats and snakes, resulting in the need to import cats from neighboring countries. The destruction of wolves also always leads to an imbalance in the number of deer and wild boars because wolves, in general, only kill sick animals. There are many such examples. But my question concerns the human level in particular. Do you agree with the statement that in nature the general is more important than the particular? Answer: but not one at the expense of the other. If we take an integral system, then each part in it is equal in value to the entire system. Otherwise, the system will not be integral, complete, and absolute. Remark: it is also stated that if a person is needed by the general system, then he exists, and if not, he does not exist. My comment: I can say this about inanimate, vegetative, and animate nature, but not about man, because he, with his egoism, interferes with nature, dominates it, and can do anything, even against common sense. Question: scientists say that all systems go through some kind of evolutionary process, development. In the beginning, there is always a process of rejection and separation in order to move to the next state, to unification, but at a higher level. Now nature has divided us with the coronavirus. We are developing a kind of virtual reality. What is the next stage of the level of connection between us? Answer: we still need to realize that our connection should, first of all, be integral and lead us to unity. We are not animals that unite instinctively. We are people, but we are against this connection. Egoism plays tough on us. So, we will have to recognize its corruption and rise above it. From Cab TV's The Post-Coronavirus Era, April 16, 2020. Medium published my new article, America's Test Will Determine Its Fate, and Ours. A few days ago, I spoke to my longtime student and friend Leonid Makarin. He reminded me that soon after the turn of the century, I told him that America was on the decline. It wasn't so obvious then, but since the financial crisis that sparked the Great Recession, it has been quite evident. The soaring rates of depression, epidemic of substance abuse, frantic purchasing of firearms and never-ending shooting incidents, and now the coronavirus disease and the anti-racism protests are all links in the chain of America's decline. The ego-based values that have brought America to greatness are now bringing on its demise, as they are doing to the rest of the world. But if America shifts direction, so will everyone else. Macron asked me how I knew then that America was declining. I told him that on one hand, it's a natural process, but on the other hand, it is not set in stone, it can be reversed. All ego-based systems go through the same cycle. They begin with rapid growth, great achievements, increasing pride, hubris, growing internal alienation, social disintegration, and finally, demise. America is going through the same process. But because America is such a dominant figure on the international arena, the process it is going through affects the whole world. It has already been through all the stages of growth, and it is well into the decline. Since the turn of the century, the process of America's social decline has become increasingly evident and has been growing at a growing speed. The violent protests, looting and shooting, anarchist elements that tear cities apart, yet encounter little resistance from law enforcement, indicate a rapid deterioration. It feels like America is racing toward the end of its life cycle. But if there was no hope, I wouldn't be writing about it. I believe that America can still save itself, and spare itself and all of us, tremendous agony. Today we know why ego-based empires sink. We know that reality is an integral whole. As a result, any part that does not take all of reality into account acts like a cancerous cell, grows by exploiting its surroundings, and finally brings on itself its own demise. The ego-based empires of the past grew like tumors and died like tumors. America evolved to greatness in the same way, but it is not dead yet. As long as people can communicate, they can connect. If they connect, they will shift from an ego-based society into an integral society that cares for all its members equally and serves as an example for the rest of the world, which currently runs solely on the ego-based model. Being the most dominant nation on Earth, such a shift in America would infuse the whole world with a new spirit. It will legitimize such values as giving, caring, and accountability, and other countries will follow suit. It is said that when Wall Street sneezes, the rest of the stock markets in the world catch a cold. The same is true for social values. The American materialism and consumerism have taken the world by storm. Now it is time to administer the antidote. The ego-based values that have brought America to greatness are now bringing on its demise, as they are doing to the rest of the world. But if America shifts direction, so will everyone else. To do that, America must do what America does best, campaign for caring. The federal government, state governments, and local authorities must all partake in a comprehensive effort to promote mutual responsibility and the importance of placing the American society as a whole above the factions in it. America has much to be proud of. The fact that people can protest so openly is by itself a testimony to the openness of American society and its ability to accept diversity. In a truly racist country, you wouldn't be able to talk about racism, you'd be locked away for doing so. Today, the resilience of the American society is being tested. If each faction takes its own direction, this great society will fall apart. Now it's time to reinforce the collective American identity, which will give the country the structural fortitude to weather the stormy times ahead. The country will have to tend to the tens of millions who have no income and will have no income going forward. It will have to teach them how to become workers for society, where they dedicate their time to strengthen the unity of the nation above all colors, races, and faiths. And while people who have jobs see to the country's sustenance, those currently jobless will see to the country's happiness. If carried out, It will be the greatest ever accomplishment in the history of humanity. It will usher the world into a new era, when nations and countries cater to each other's needs rather than venture to control them, and the whole planet will prosper and thrive as it truly can. Two kinds of love. Question: how can the principle love your neighbor as yourself be fulfilled if I love my neighbor with selfish love, but I must love him altruistically? Answer: indeed, these are two kinds of love. But you can love another person more than yourself if you begin to realize that to love another is the same love, only at the next level, global, integral, eternal, perfect. And to love yourself means that you love only at the animal level. Therefore, it is impossible to compare love external, integral and internal, linear, selfish. When both types of love arise in a person, he begins to love eternity, perfection, and the world more than his animal body. From Cab TV's Fundamentals of Kabbalah, April 19, 2020. New Life 1202. The Mirror Effect.
Hello, and thanks for being with us on the New Life Show with Dr. Michael Lightman. Hello, Dr. Lightman. Hello, everyone. Hello, Tal Mandelbaum. Hello. And today we'd like to talk about the mirror effect. We live in a society. Around us, there are other people. Some say that the people around us project to some extent who we really are on the inside, something that we can't see on ourselves, but that we can really see on others. So this is what we'd like to talk about today. Be with us, Tal, please. Yeah, if we look at different sites of self-change, psychology, relationships, things that have to do with how can a person improve himself in his life, there's this recommendation to understand that other people are your mirror. Suppose things that you like about other people say something about you. Things that make you mad and irritate you and others also say something about you. And we'd like to learn how to correctly relate to this. Is it true that others are actually a kind of mirror of who I am? Undoubtedly. No doubt that we don't see people for who they are, and also we have no idea, no clue of how to see a person for who he is. I put it this way, any person that we see, or in general, any object that we see, is a kind of piece of rock. It doesn't matter what. That still has no shape, nor color, shape, smell, nothing. But we, by looking at it, as if bring it to life, it comes alive according to what we want to see in it. And each and every person in and of himself does not exist. But I see that person according to what I want to see in that person. What do you mean that I want to see something in someone? That I look at someone. Sometimes we don't even see people. We don't see them. We look, but they pass by. It's like they don't stand out in the background. And then more and more, to the measure to which we get to know someone, that we already have some kind of impression, then we relate to that person in a certain way, and then even before I start talking or something to that person, I already depict their image inside of me from previous impressions. Because every time some kind of impression registered in me from that person, and therefore there are no people. We don't know any person for who he is. we only know these images that you can say that we sculpture before us. I remember this example they gave us in the university, that when we look at people from a different nation or culture that look different than we do, they all look the same to us. All Chinese people look the same, meaning because we have no discernments about these people, they all seem similar to us. And only when we start to get to know them, we see differences, colors, things. So is it so that in our cognitive abilities, we simply don't see details that we're not familiar with? We see only that which we shape ourselves out of our exterior impressions. At first, I have nothing. And then we start differentiating. At first, I don't see your hair or eyebrows or eyes or anything. But bit by bit, by starting to attribute these parts to you, suppose to your face, then accordingly I start relating to you, identifying you. And this is facial recognition and the recognition of a person. It's an entire method. It's not simple. It's not that I feel like it, I see and grasp, not at all. Because we're not a photographic image. We're not a photographic machine. We're not a camera. We are an emotional camera because we have only emotions, our desire to receive. And when I picture you in my desire to receive. And then how do I picture you? What do you mean in the desire to receive? The desire to receive meaning the desire to receive pleasure. So I look at you. Your hair. Suppose I can somewhat enjoy it. Your eyebrows, for sure. The nose, not that much. Your smile, for sure. So, this way, you register in me. Only in the way of giving me more or less pleasure. I don't photograph your eyebrows, and cheeks, and lips, or nose, or anything. I photograph my impression. But see how unique your impression in me is compared to my impression of millions of other women. From all other women's faces. How complex we are on the inside. It's like when the police want to put together someone's facial image, facial composite. Yeah. It's the same with us, only for us it's something emotional. I don't put together the eyebrows and the eyes and where's the nose, this fits, this doesn't, change it, and so on. No, I also do it this way. This is how it's done inside a person, but out of the desire to enjoy something more or less. Up until now, you talked about a person's appearance. Does it also have to do with a person's behavior? Anything. I look at a building, at a cow, a child, airplane, you name it. I always picture them in my will to receive. It's the desire to receive pleasure. My wife. She behaves in a certain way. I want to ask specifically about behavior. Wait a second. This and the power of. So please explain. Because up until now we talked about appearance. We're an emotional camera. We build a facial composite. There's like raw material. And out of it we gradually shape what we want to see through our emotional camera. Yeah, but it's not that we only see things that are pleasant to us. Pleasant or unpleasant, it doesn't matter. But we picture it in our feelings. And what registers in my feelings. What about danger? To the measure to which each and every detail that I identify about Ms. Tal is pleasant or unpleasant to me. So, it's not only that it could bring me pleasure, it could also harm me. I'll picture that too. I have to be careful. Of course. But that's all you have. only this sense called the will to receive. This is all you have. Okay, now I want to ask about behaviors. Up until now we talked about appearance. I understood that I picture everything around me according to what suits. You just pictured her. And she seems nice, pretty, pleasant. And now you're starting to get impressions from her behavior. And then you're saying, alas, this is a real monster. And what happens? You also change her face, her countenance, her appearance. For you, it's truly an inner revolution. This is already to the power of two, behavior. There are a few more. To the power of what? There is, because there is who she in and of herself is. Now you can say, I know who she is, but it means that I know that this is how I pictured her. I know I'm familiar with her behavior. I know who she is internally. Now, what can I do in relation to her to change this facial composite in me? Whether it's for the better in one direction or in the other direction, depending on how I have to use this in me, that these two forms that I have photographed, the outer and the inner, these are two forms in which I have as if photographed her in an objective way, but it can never be objective because it's inside of me and I'm the desire to receive pleasure. But this is my impression, that this is how it is. Now I start working with her, meaning how am I supposed to accept her and for what purpose?
Okay.
And then here I can change my attitude toward her. Whether I need it, or society needs it, or I suppose she's my child's kindergarten teacher. And so on and so forth. So the use that I get out of this person will influence the way that I see them, feel them, and so on. Of course, that if I have to be connected with that person, then I already begin upon my impression to bring new forms in order to color my impressions in a more precise way according to your image, suppose. Suppose you're my child's kindergarten teacher. And then, even though that I don't want to, but I have no choice, I give you presents, this, that. I have to care and so on. Meaning, on the one hand, I remain with my impression. On the other hand, I act as much as I can in order to as if have a different impression, that I want to change your facial composite in me, even though that in the meantime it remains. And sometimes this way we can really change our attitude toward people. That I say that really is a completely different person than the way I pictured them at first. Or that they're conning me or something, but this mirror effect, it's our entire life. We're not aware of the measure to which we photograph all the time and change these pictures in my inner album. Suppose if I attribute the quality of grumpiness to someone, and I think that that's terrible, what am I supposed to understand from this about myself, that this is how I see them? No, this you can't answer. It's very primitive. So he's grumpy, irritable. You can learn that it's good or not. Maybe it is good. Depends on the situation. Because if something really irritates me about someone else, it probably says something about me that I behave this way and I just see that in them. First of all, in order to be impressed with someone, you also have to be included of that quality, otherwise you won't understand what's going on. So if I see something that exists in someone else, I have to first of all understand that it exists in me. I approach a baby, and I make a smiling face, or a sad face, or an angry face. He won't understand it. If he's really a baby, he looks at me and, you know, one way or another, he wants closeness. And after some time, then he can already start telling the difference. And accordingly, he responds. It's something that you can see. So, what are we supposed to get out of this if we understand that we only see the subjective photograph of another person? We have to treat everyone favorably, give a good example to everyone as much as we can in order to break them with love, by love. What does it mean to break someone by love? Their impression of me, their negative impression of me, that was registered this way in them, I want to change it into a positive one. How? I have to give them an impression of myself so that they will understand how much I really want to their benefit. And then, up to the point where love covers all crimes, that over all of those first impressions that were as crimes, will come love, that the other person will see no flaw in me, about me, even though that at first, the way his ego pictured me, photographed me, the only thing he saw was flaws. Okay, and now we turn the camera around. He has the camera, and I'm concerned about how he sees me. Why am I concerned with that? Otherwise, how can I connect with the other person? This is my entire work in life, to so-called turn my enemy into my lover. So your assumption is that when one person looks at another person, his impression of that other person is necessarily in advance negative. Always. Everyone looks at others through the point of view of what can I get out of that person? How can I use them? Exploit them? Everyone does. And if I can't, then there's no point in relating to that person. I immediately show disregard. And if I can, then I look for how can I exploit that person. For men, it's in the specific way that men do it, how much more powerful they are, or that they use each other. And women, it's to the measure to which each of them feels herself more beautiful, successful, appealing, attractive, and so on, compared to another woman. But it's always according to a person's own ego. So we're all emotional cameras that my inner mechanism relates to all other objects through this egoistic perspective, and then I have these different pictures that are formed in me through this camera. And this is how it is in each and every one of us, that each of us has this inner photo album. Especially if you talk to women. With men, it doesn't stand out that much. But if a woman looks at another woman, first of all, she sees how different is she. Is she more than I am, less than I am, the differences between us? And to his advantage. So, such a photo album is created instinctively in each of us. Now, we live in a society. Everyone has their own inner album that's reshaped every time, and we have to create some kind of relationship. At work, at home, doesn't matter where. After I understand everything that you explained up until now about the inner mechanisms of how we see reality, how can I now successfully connect, build a successful relationship with someone else? What are the necessary conditions for it? You said the first condition is that I have to treat everyone favorably, to break them by love, so that the inner image of myself that was created in them will start changing. Yes. What else do I have to know in order to start building a good relationship? This is in regard to how I influence the way they perceive me. How about the way I perceive them? Because all the people around me are depicted in me in a certain way. Through my egoistic eyes, this I understand. Can I change these pictures? Suppose there's something about Tal that I can't stand, a certain quality that I can't stand, and what can I do? She's my boss at work, or I'm her boss, or we're just colleagues and we have to work together. Or we have to do, doesn't matter what, there's something about her that is standing in the way of our connection. Now you're saying that it's not really in her, but this is how she's perceived in your inner album, picture album. Can I change that? Of course, but externally. Can you explain? You have to raise her importance above your inner impression. That's called love covers all crimes. What is that? That the benefit from her covers your impression. So much so that afterwards you will stop even recalling, even though that it'll remain on the inside, but that there's something negative about her, because you'll enjoy her so much so in your work that there'll be no other calculation here. Even though that she walks around with this hairdo that you don't like, suppose. Oh, you know, hairdo doesn't bother me. That's her life. Usually what bothers us are people's behaviors. There are things that I can't stand, kinds of behavior. And now I'm adding the way I see it, because I'm an emotional camera, so I don't know anymore. No problem. It's all according to gain and loss. There's no other way. Only according to gain and loss. What does he have to do? This is how we always do it. Again, like we said, we are all in all the desire to receive pleasure, to the measure to which I enjoy, and to the measure to which I lose. And so we calculate. How does he reach a state where he can enjoy someone that he can't stand their behavior? But he enjoys in a different way. What can I do? Suppose you're an expert in something. Along with it, your behavior is really terrible. So what can you do? You agree with it. Suppose every 5 minutes you go smoking. And every 10 minutes you talk on the phone. But along with it, according to what we see, at work, you're really the bomb, so to speak. You solve all problems, you make such reports that we can't do without you. We wanted to get rid of you, but we can't. So, we bear your phone calls, your cigarettes, and continue with you. So, it's something external to calculate gain and loss, and accordingly, I can stand that. But, suppose in a family, there it's something else. In the family, I have to reach a state where the qualities that I can't stand about another person that gradually become revealed, I need either to uproot them completely in my spouse, suppose, or to agree with it, love these qualities, bear them, and agree with the way she behaves. Otherwise, what can I do? Here, it's love covers all crimes. What does this sentence mean? It means that even though that I disagree with something about another person, when I approach that person with love, I start loving all of their negative qualities because they're his, they're theirs, hers. And that person for me is precious. So it's important for me to relate. And in someone else, I can't stand it. But in them, I can. So why do I stand it here? Because I love the other person, that other person. And then everything about her, I suppose, doesn't reject me. So much so that she became close to me. Why? Because it belongs, it's a part of that person, and I enjoy that person. Yeah, but this specifically, I can't stand. No, it's so much so, there's also the matter of mutuality here. If I feel that that person's devoted to me, then everything behind that devotion, that soul devotion to me, it covers it. Their devotion covers for it. That's what we call in the wisdom of Kabbalah, dvikut, adhesion. Now, what about all of these sayings that you have to be that change that you want to see in the world, meaning that if you'll make some kind of inner change, you'll start seeing reality differently? True. So much so that I stop feeling about that other person that I love. I stop seeing flaws in them. Like a mom sees no flaws in her baby, and someone else, you know, they look and, what is that? But the mother sees no flaws. The baby's perfect. So what changes do we have to make in order to see a good, loving reality? Love. Love covers all crimes. And if suppose I become more loving, how does that change my reality? It only changes the way I interpret reality, or reality changes, and that's that. The main thing is our impression. A world has no form of its own. The form's always registered in our will to receive. And therefore, I never see anything ever objectively as it is, because it has no form. The form's always in the common attitude between myself and that thing that I'm in contact with. Last question. Suppose Tal, she's my boss at work. And she's really, from time to time, she's unbearable. Now, what do I have to do? What kind of change has to happen in me? Love. What is that? You have to rise above your complaints against her and see that your complaints are personal, specific, that there's no room for them at all in your relationship, that it's simply a result of two nervous systems or psychological systems, to some extent, not being able to be an equivalence of form. But either through appreciation or love, you can bring yourself to a state where you will see no flaw about her. No flaw. Suppose I have a teacher, and he's really smart, and he teaches me, and he cares for me and everything. And he himself, I don't see any flaws about him. But were I to look at him from the outside in, through different eyes, he'd look ugly and whatnot. In short, it all depends on the benefit, on how close you are, on the measure to which your desire to receive pleasure enjoys that as if external image that you photograph and picture in your desire to receive pleasure. Dr. Lightman, thank you very much. Thank you, Tal. Thank you for being with us. Till next time, all the best.